Welcome to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Joseph Brodsky, a winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1987, was the United States National Poet Laureate in 1991. Born in what is now St. Petersburg, Russia, when it was called Leningrad, he grew up in a communal apartment and was very active in language and literary pursuits, receiving a great deal of attention in that area from his mother. In 1963, Brodsky was denounced by a Leningrad newspaper that called his poetry pornographic and anti-Soviet. He was interrogated and his papers were seized, and twice he was put in mental institutions. He was arrested and indicted on a charge of parasitism, and in a secret trial, he was called a pseudo-poet in velveteen trousers who failed to fulfill his constitutional duty to work honestly for the good of the motherland. Yet no fault was found with the content of his poetry. One of the more interesting comments Joseph Brodsky made when he was a guest on this program in 1991, when it was called Government, Politics, and Ideas, was his suggestion that there be a book of poetry in every hotel room right next to the Bible. He said he didn't think that the telephone book would mind. He began our conversation by describing the role of the poet laureate and his ideas about poetry.
One is in this position, is responsible for organizing readings in Washington at the Library of Congress with the purpose of introducing, as it were, to the nation the works of people not terribly well known, or well known perhaps, somewhat known, and also to oversee the program of recording those individuals for, technically speaking, for the posterity. Also oversee somewhat the appropriation of by the library of collections of poetry in the well published in the land. Well, things of that nature. Well, it includes even the responsibility, the duty of giving writing. Of giving tours of the library to the visitors. It's they're multifarious, those duties. Not only taxing, mind you, but also what I've discovered mainly, well, for the last 2 months that I've been doing this, that the main sort of task is connected with the mail, because one receives an extraordinary amount of manuscripts which either inquire about which solicit either opinion or endorsement.
Let me ask you about the function of poetry in a culture. You, I know, are familiar with the Russian culture in the area of Leningrad and now St. Petersburg, where you grew up, and I know that you're very familiar with the American culture. And I wonder if you could comment on the function of poetry in a culture from your perspective, having a multicultural background.
Well, function of poetry in the culture, poetry is the part of the culture, or culture is, in a sense, if you will, is a spin-off of poetry, because poetry is a very, how should I put to you, very ancient enterprise. A song came before the story, if you don't mind my saying so. And it's simply, well, since we're on the radio, I guess I should be succinct. Well, I would say poetry generates culture, that's all. That's what's function there.
In the current issue of the New Republic, the November 11th, 1991 issue, you have presented a perspective which you call an immodest proposal.
That's an editorial choice.
All right. I see that it's a play on a title of someone else.
I know that.
Mm-hmm. But you indicate that the culture needs to come halfway to the poet, or the society needs to come halfway to the poet to receive and distribute the poet's works. Can you articulate or tell us a little bit about...
I can try. Well, basically, there is that issue raised by various people in various parts of society, time and again, about the duty or responsibility of a poet to society. There are many ways to court boredom, and this this issue is surely a shortcut. Essentially, it's a funny issue. Because poet is, in a sense, is a self-employed. He is not appointed by society. So it's not for society to, so to speak, to talk about. Presumably by the right of majority, in a sense. Society can talk about the responsibility of a poet towards it, but it would be hard to envision how would society determine the duty, and should the poet then abide by that definition? That would be, in a sense, tyranny. On the other hand, a poet is also not to define the duty of his duty towards society, because he's in the minority of one, and the minority of one is not supposed to define its, how should I put it, relation towards the majority. That would be anarchy. Essentially, poet has only one duty. On this earth, this is to write well. It's duty not so much towards his society, or even to his immediate, social context, if you will. But it's his duty towards the language. Ultimately, it's his, so to speak, duty to himself. It has to do with the self-esteem to produce a work of lasting consequence, of enduring, if you will, beauty. By doing that, by writing in the language of society, and by writing well, he takes a gigantic, in my view, step towards the society, and the society's job is presumably to meet him halfway, that is to read his work. I'm talking in that sort of a singular manner, a poet. Basically, we're talking about the poets. There are plenty of poets in this country, not to mention the huge patrimony of poetry in this country, which simply are not read by society. That is, plenty of men of letters, so to speak, took gigantic strides towards their respective contemporaries, and yet, they haven't been read. And my job as a poet laureate, the way I understand it, is to simply to change the situation somewhat, to spread the word.
How do you propose to change the situation?
I'm trying to use every opportunity at hand, and there are not that many, to convince the publishers to produce collections of poetry in a greater volume. That's A. B, to distribute them in a more sensible and more substantial manner than they normally do. Normally, poetry is collections of poetry are segregated to the bookstores, which are segregated either to the main drugs or the university campuses in this country. There are vast territories in the nation which have no bookstores practically. Within the sensible radius. So my idea would be simply to make publishers to think, or distributors, if you will, to think a bit more enterprisingly. That is to contact, let's say, supermarket chains, drugstores, that sort of thing. And as you quoted at the beginning, the motel chains. The thing is that there is a sort of old assumption that very small percentage of public of society reads poetry. Well, the perception is both accurate and inaccurate. Well, that is, well, it's accurate in terms of, indeed, that the numbers of poetry readers are somewhat limited. Well, the reasons for which are cited, well, and from that is from that very often people infer the notion that poetry is not terribly significant in the lives of people. Well, it is so simply because of the small numbers in which it's being published. And the small numbers, the phenomenon of these small numbers, it comes from a certain inertia that exists. Well, it's practically medieval, or let's say Renaissance, if to give it a more noble sound. Inertia, simply because it has to do with the period when indeed, both writing and reading poetry was the privilege of the few. That is, the privilege of those who were literate. Literacy was limited and was the privilege of the few people, of the fewer people than today. Nowadays, practically, everyone is literate. Up to a certain degree, of course. But this qualifying understanding, essentially, everybody is literate, and for that reason, everybody is entitled or capable of reading poetry. However, the publishing proceeds by the criteria which owes, so to speak, its existence, let's say, to the time immemorial, to the past. Well, the publishing doesn't take into consideration this phenomenon of nearly universal literacy.
In the New Republic article, you write that poetry is not a form of entertainment, and in a certain sense, not even a form of art, but our anthropological genetic goal, our linguistic evolutionary beacon. I wonder if you could comment on that, as poetry being an anthropological or an evolutionary act.
It's very simple. From the rest of the animal kingdom is our ability for speech. Presumably we should try to master the highest forms of that speech. That would be logical, wouldn't it be? And poetry is simply the supreme form of human locution. This way, poetry is indeed our anthropological, our genetic goal.
You go on to use the reference in your article in the New Republic and write that we seem to sense this as children when we absorb and remember verses in order to master language. As adults, however, we abandon this pursuit, convinced that we have mastered it. And then what you say following, I think, sheds a great deal of light on it, and I'd like you to elaborate if you can when you write, "Yet we've mastered, what we have mastered is but an idiom, good enough perhaps to outfox an enemy, to sell a product, to get laid, to earn a promotion, but certainly not good enough to cure anguish or cause joy."
That's right, I've said that, and I don't think I can elaborate on it. It says that.
You go on to talk about an anthropological crime if we don't distribute poetry. What do you mean by that?
We simply slow down our evolvement, our own, so to speak, evolution. As a species, more narrowly as individuals. We could have been far more advanced, far more intricate, far more mentally enterprising individuals had we read poetry more frequent basis than we do. And whatever slows that, and whatever prevents us from doing it, is indeed an anthropological crime. It's a crime against our, so to speak, nature. I put it in a bit shrill, in a bit drastic manner, for a very simple reason, because I want people to simply to cut off changing their practices. It's, how should I put it to you? Maybe I say that in that same article. We seem to have a very high sentiment about, well, the Nazis, well, somewhere in the 30s when Hitler came to power, about them burning books. But I think a process far more perhaps pernicious than burning books is not reading books, yeah? Well, and that's, I think, well, what we are, in a sense, guilty of.
Can you give us your thoughts on perhaps poetry on television? Since people
would be against, well, I understand that it's a medium that was most popular, most well, of a greater access to the people. But I think, well, I'm against poetry on television. I'm against poetry on the video and that sort of thing, simply because poetry is not a visual experience. Well, nor it is, well, in the final analysis, even an audio experience, although it has more with that to do with that than with the visual experience. Poetry, well, what distinguishes poetry, or literature for that matter, from other arts is that it doesn't it doesn't employ so much the human viscera. Well, the adventure that takes place during the reading takes place not on the surface of your senses, well, but it takes place right in your mind.
But there is a performance aspect or a listening aspect to the society that hears the poet, particularly in the pre-literate society. And if we have the poetry...
We are not. Well, it was fine for Homer to recite his hexameters to the public gatherings, etc., etc., etc. But, well, he was doing that simply for the reasons of illiteracy on the part of the society, yeah? We are literate. We can read it. Well, and it's, reading poetry or dealing with poetry, it's ultimately the most intimate experience. Well, this is something that you, in the final analysis, can't really properly share. Well, that is, well, it's, well, poetry deals with individual on tete-a-tete basis. And, the thing about the visual experiences or audio experiences, if you will, well, that they are, in fact, in the final analysis, they undercut the aspect of your personal responsibility in what you're doing, in what you, well, when you read, it becomes, it's your own act. You register what you read, you think about what you read. Whereas when you're given that on the screen, or through the amplifier, it just leaves your retina or the membrane the next second. It doesn't stay.
You mentioned earlier in our discussion that America has a huge patrimony of poetry. Do you feel that the body of poetry, if that's what you're referring to, is greater in this country than it is in other cultures?
I honestly do think so.
Can you explain?
Simply even numerically. To begin with, this is a very populous nation. And for the last century and a half, you had an extraordinary amount of remarkable work produced. I think we have more poetry, so to speak, produced per capita, if I can use this terminology here, than Germany or than France. I'm taking them separately, not together.
Then if we take the patrimony of poetry and your analysis that America is now a literate country, would that be the distinction that you might draw between the more bardic tradition of European poetry and, as you said, Homer reading to the masses?
I'm not terribly clear on the distinction that you're trying to make. What I'm trying to say is that that this country, by the means of the poetry available to it, yet not touched, could be fairly quickly, turned into enlightened democracy. Well, and there is every opportunity for that. Well, there is every, there is little will. That's the problem as I see it. And what I'm trying to do is to alert the will. Well, as for the bardic tradition, it depends, it varies even in this nation, and it varies on the continent. Well, the modern idiom of delivery a poem is a sort of a deadpan, flat, unemphatic manner. Well, because many a poet is sort of afraid of or apprehensive of a sardonic mind, of a sardonic reader who would just smirk at the poet's delights and raptures, and so therefore he tries to be a poet tries to be sort of a deadpan level, speaking of deadpan level voice, to abandon, so to speak, that bardic tradition that you call it. But poetry, as you see, it's a great mistake in my view, because poetry is not an act of self-effacement. It's an art of assertion. And if you want to be self-effacing, well, you can, as a poet, you can take the next logical step and completely shut up.
When you make a reference to an enlightened democracy, I hear an indication with which I would agree as to the darkness of our democracy now.
It's dimming.
In trying to lighten it up, do you have a feeling or an idea or a focus in your role as the National Poet Laureate about how we can enlighten our democracy beyond distribution of the poetry as you've described earlier this evening? Or do you see a focus of teaching poetry in the schools?
Well, there is that, but it always, you can't really legislate or introduce it, that sort of thing, or introduce it on the federal basis, on the level of federal government. The most natural thing would be to think about some equivalent of Ministry of Culture, but in our country, it won't work. Simply, when we hear of federal government, we immediately think of the post office. Well, of course, it would be attractive to change the teaching, to get a better teachers of literature, etc. But that may transpire, that may come to pass. But it's not the case right now, and I'm dealing with the situation at hand. What I want to do to create a situation whereupon it's distributed in a far grander manner, poetry, and I would say something else. I would say history. What I think what should be done is that we should sort of have compile somehow, I don't really know who, a body of historians, if you will, we should compile a canon of historical events as we know them through recorded history, and give each phenomenon, each event, let's say the uprising of Spartacus, the fall of Rome, I don't really know what, the Peloponnesian War, you name it, minimum to each phenomenon, to each event, we should give that sort of a canon. Canon should have three interpretations, so that a pupil, a student, an individual reading it would be able to pick up his own interpretation of the event. That is to give him, so to speak, a multiple choice. Yeah. Well, this will, apart from anything else, this will engage people into a more enterprising, in their personal involvement. It would create an element of personal involvement in individuals' assessment of historical facts. It will give him a more sort of a stereoscopic sense of what happened to us, to the species, throughout history. This way we will think in a more, how should I put it, in a more multifaceted manner.
Let me ask you about your travels as the National Poet Laureate. You indicated that you will be traveling to Albuquerque in the next few days. Is it your plan or part of your duties to travel around the country and promote what we've been talking about and other ideas?
Well, In a sense, it's not the part of my duty, but I regard it as such. I dislike doing that, but, well, I think it's necessary. Well, I'm not doing that normally. Normally what I do as a poet of some repute, I'm getting invited to this or that place, and then I go and read my own poems. Well, this year, being sort of hired, as it were, by the Library of Congress, in Washington, I regard myself, so to speak, as a public servant. I'll just try to do. That's exactly what I'm going to do. For the duration of this year, as much as I can do it. Well,
you mentioned that you perhaps fancy yourself as sort of a surgeon general.
Yeah, that effect, yeah.
Can you tell us about that?
Well, it's along the same lines, to improve the national, how should I put it, cultural, not exactly health, well, I don't presume so much, but habits, to make the nation develop better habits. It's like quitting smoking, though I smoke.
Well, Joseph Brodsky, the National Poet Laureate, I want to thank you very much for being with us here on...
Well, thank you very much.
And hopefully in your travels, you will be coming to the reaches of Northern California.
I dearly hope I will. Well, thank you very much.
Joseph Brodsky received the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1987. And was the United States National Poet Laureate in 1991. He is the author of many books, including A Part of Speech, a volume of poetry published in 1977, Less Than One, a book of essays published in 1986, To Urania, a book of poems published in 1998, Marbles, a play in three acts published in 1989. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.